If we dismiss the men who painted their faces black as deluded racists, we miss what they were telling us, even if subconsciously, about what free Americans were missing from their lives. As we will see, much of what they missed could be found in the lives of real slaves. Yet, those who wished to be considered good American citizens knew that distancing oneself from all that African American culture represented was a principal qualification. So, they allowed themselves to enjoy the pleasures of blackness only vicariously. This is not an endorsement of slavery, but it is an argument that many freedoms we now cherish were available only to slaves in early America, and that citizenship in the young republic was a terribly constrained thing. It also reveals why slaves and their descendants were able to create a culture that has been so envied and resented, not just by white Americans, but also by the world.
Okay, everybody, patience, please. Trust me, it's going to be okay. So what you've heard so far are excerpts from Chapter 2 in Thaddeus Russell's book, A Renegade History of the United States. And the title of that chapter is The Freedom of Slavery. That's a controversial title, I agree. Chapter 3 is called The Slavery of Freedom, and the set of ideas within those two chapters is what we're going to be discussing on the show today. But I think from the excerpt, you've already gotten some idea of what Chapter 2 is driving at. But I want to be clear up front that slavery is more than just a physical thing, isn't it? It's very much a mental thing. And there were a lot of men, you might not believe it. There were a lot of mentally enslaved people back in the early days of America. And originally, it was, you know, people who had the Puritan work ethic jammed into their psyche from a very young age, either through society or through the schools. But after the end of the Civil War, during the period of Reconstruction into the 20th century, many freed black people and the descendants of freed black people adopted that mindset as well. And once you learn a more complete story about slavery and plantation life, which was not good, right? Which is nothing to look back at with any kind of nostalgia. And this is a challenging chapter, but there are some important lessons. If we can, you know, hold off on knee-jerking responses, which at times is difficult. We'll start here. One of the reasons why I wanted to explore this topic is I had a lot of questions about this period in time, the middle of the 19th century, the end of slavery, and the period known as Reconstruction after the Civil War. There are a lot of varying views on what happened and why during that time. I had some, I thought, pretty well-researched conclusions. And one of the things that you'll hear me bring up in the show today is that what happened after the Civil War in the United States, it seemed that it began a long but steady process of distributing slavery thinly to everybody. Now, there might be many people who are listening who find that statement to be highly offensive, and that's understandable if we don't properly define slavery. So we're not saying, hey, if you are a so-called citizen in the United States of America, you know, you are basically like these people who, I mean, and there are so many horror stories related to slavery, families being pulled apart, primarily being the worst, but also, you know, just the general being a slave thing. I just want to reiterate, this is not an effort in any way to glamorize slavery or to say that it's the same kind of condition to be a citizen. But I was working, when I read this chapter, I was working off this Harriet Tubman quote that I had heard so many times in life. And Harriet Tubman once said, I've used it in the show before, many times. I freed thousands of slaves and I could have freed thousands more if they had known they were slaves, or if I had could have convinced them that they were slaves, right? Now that, I always thought, spoke to a mindset of defeat and dependence. And now I'm not sure. So the distribution and thinly spreading of slavery, which is spread but less intense after the federal government gains a tremendous amount of power from not only the process of the Civil War, but the amendments that are added to the Constitution after the Civil War. That's what we're speaking to here.
And most of this, I believed, was accomplished through the passage of the very controversial passage, mind you, of the 14th Amendment. Now, what the 14th Amendment was supposed to do, well, let's bring some other voices into this. When Thaddeus was at Columbia, his advisor was probably one of the top authorities in the world on Reconstruction scholarship, Eric Foner. So let's go to him for the official view from academia.
The 14th Amendment, which was passed through Congress in 1866 and then ratified by the states a couple of years later, changes the Constitution in a couple of fundamental ways. The Bill of Rights had protected our basic liberties against interference by the federal government. It begins with the words, "Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, the press, etc." The 14th Amendment is directed at the states, not at the federal government. The states now have to recognize the equality of before the law of all citizens, what they call equal protection of the law, and due process of law, and states cannot deprive any individual of life, liberty, or property. So now, instead of the Bill of Rights, which restricts Congress, now the 14th Amendment empowers Congress to oversee and override measures of the state governments that interfere with the basic equal rights of American citizens. So it's a fundamental shift in the federal system. It makes the national government the protector of the basic rights of citizens, not the state governments. Also, it introduces this notion of equality for the first time into the Constitution. The word equality does not exist in the original Constitution. And it's the 14th Amendment which makes the Constitution what it has been ever since. A document to which groups of Americans who feel aggrieved, who feel their rights have been violated, can go and, you know, they can claim their constitutional rights in court. And so it really makes the Constitution a vehicle for groups that feel aggrieved, which it really hadn't been before the Civil War. So it's a fundamental shift in the federal system. It makes the national government the protector of the basic rights of citizens.
Well, you know, what could go wrong? And that's pretty standard. I think that's what people would learn in most colleges. And you're going to probably read Foner's book if you study history in college. And my understanding was very similar to that.
Now, you can even see this argument as having some merit, right? Especially if you look in the South in the 1860s and 1870s and 1880s, right? There's institutionalized racism. Remember, too, that the civil rights legislation that came 100 years later in the 1960s was similar. You could even say, some would argue, less impactful than the 14th Amendment passed in the 1860s. But at the time, you could certainly make a very reasonable argument that something like this makes sense, considering the predation of these governments of states in the South against black people. Certainly, it's valid. In the 1950s and 1960s, in a still largely segregated South, it might have seemed like it would make sense then, too, to a lot of people who are not familiar with a lot of the political philosophy that we talk about on this show, to empower the federal government, primarily Congress, to enforce the protection of life, liberty, and property in these very racist southern states, right? The problem in the minds of the supporters of all of this, right? And this is a very tangled web. The problem is not the institution of government, you know, existing to enforce this kind of racism and predation and disenfranchisement, etc. Not the institution of government, it's the state governments, and they need to be regulated and controlled from above. Strangely, not strangely, what has happened over the course of the last 150 years is that those words, life, liberty, and property, have been kind of altered, meddled with by federal government, by the Supreme Court, and it's allowed the federal government to increase its power over the states. So states' rights is basically a thing of the past. The federal government continues to grow and grow and grow and answer to its masters. That's shorthand for a very big subject. And I was introduced to this controversy when I was much more of a left-wing guy through the work of Howard Zinn. And here's his viewpoint captured in a 2-minute clip from the film The Corporation.
The Civil War and the Industrial Revolution created enormous growth in corporations. And so there was an explosion of railroads who got large federal subsidies of land, banking, heavy manufacturing, and corporate lawyers a century and a half ago realized they needed more power to operate and wanted to remove some of the constraints that had historically been placed on the corporate form.
The 14th Amendment was passed at the end of the Civil War to give equal rights to black people. And therefore, it said no state can deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And that was intended to prevent the states from taking away life, liberty, or property from black people, as they had done for so much of our history. And what happens is the corporations come into court, and corporation lawyers are very clever, and they say, oh, you can't deprive a person of life, liberty, or property. We are a person. A corporation is a person. And the Supreme Court goes along with that.
And what was particularly grotesque about this was that the 14th Amendment was passed to protect newly freed slaves. So, for instance, between 1890 and 1910, there were 307 cases brought before the court under the 14th Amendment. 288 of these brought by corporations, 19 by African Americans.
~600,000 people were killed to get rights for people. And then, with strokes of the pen over the next 30 years, judges applied those rights to capital and property while stripping them from people.
And for added emphasis, an excerpt from a lecture on the 14th Amendment given by Tom Woods. And in this clip, you'll hear Tom do what, gosh, I have to say, a lot of libertarians seem to be really good at doing, and that's pointing out the totally obvious thing that, for some reason, nobody else seems to be looking at very closely.
Let's first look at the issue of the ratification of the 14th Amendment, and then see, in practice, where has the 14th Amendment gone? Has it, if the 14th Amendment could be enforced by angels, then I might support it. If it could be enforced by angels, or, you know, at the very least, people whose view of rights is the same as our view of rights, then I would almost not have a problem with it, or I'd have much less of a problem with it. The difficulty is that people who are on the Supreme Court or on these federal courts, to say the least, don't necessarily have our same view of rights. So when they say, oh, we're just intervening to uphold the Bill of Rights in the states, well, their interpretation of the Bill of Rights is not always yours. As we'll see, there was a time in the 1970s where the Supreme Court almost found that the Constitution contains a guaranteed minimum income for all Americans as a right. So if you're going to say, well, you know, we need somebody to keep the states in line, so let's go with the Supreme Court, again, be careful. As I say, in strict theory, if the Supreme Court had angels on it, that might be a good idea. But in the long run, it might actually be better to have to live with some rotten state decision. At least you can move out of that state. You have some recourse.
So we know how that works. If enforced by angels, yes. But that's not who runs the government. That's not who's attracted to government. And the results, as far as the amount of freedom that people have in this country, and we're not talking about, see, we've been asked, really, I think, most of our lives to focus on consumer freedoms. Of course, we are seldom encouraged to look at political liberty, to look at our changing relationship with the people who call themselves government and claim dominion over the land on which we live. Don't do that, they say. You're just going to upset people, they tell you.
But there's a confluence of things that contribute to that lack of freedom, that comparative lack of freedom, political freedom today. Now, I had this one explanation for what happened, and it started with this idea that the 14th Amendment empowered the federal government, but when I was like more of a Howard Zinn left-wing kind of guy, no, I still stand by this, even though this my focus has expanded a little bit. It's not as narrow as it used to be, but I agreed with what Howard Zinn said, right? The 14th Amendment empowers the federal government, but who does the federal government answer to? Large corporations. So obviously the people and their freedoms, their liberty, their lives, their property are going to be casualties of that. And there's an associate professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. His name is George Thomas. He was interviewed on Reason TV about the 14th Amendment and the question of economic liberty. I just want to read you this description and then we'll talk about it. Thomas notes that for most of our nation's history, there wasn't a rigid distinction between civil and economic liberties. And that's kind of the big divide, at least in rhetoric, between the political parties now. The Bill of Rights treated them all as fundamental rights. And as can be seen in the famous passage, the 14th Amendment continued this tradition. Quote, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Okay, well, there's a big door kicked open. Nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, end quote. Thomas explains that the separation between civil and economic liberties began during the Franklin Roosevelt era, when various economic liberties seemed to be written out of the Constitution. He shows how recent Supreme Court decisions, such as in Kelo versus the City of New London, that was in Connecticut, which granted governments wider economic domain powers, and McDonald versus Chicago, which extended the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms to states and localities, figure into how America defines and protects fundamental rights and economic liberties. Okay. So just a little bit of added detail about Kelo versus New London. That was when the City of New London, Connecticut, wanted to use eminent domain to clear residences to build, I think, don't quote me on this, I'm getting the general idea right, I might not have all the details right, some kind of Pfizer plant, the pharmaceutical company. And their rationalization, or the New London's rationalization, was that it was in the economic interest of the town of New London. It was for the greater good. And one of the participants, several times in the past on School Sucks, Lauren Canario, actually went down and occupied that land with a group of other people that the government wanted to take. And she did this before occupying was cool. Now, I think there's an important thing to point out here as well. You know, like people on the left, the liberals, the progressives, they talk about civil liberties. And this is how they attract a lot of people, as we've covered before, to their cause. But there's an interesting question that comes up here. Can you have any liberty without economic liberty? Because like it or not, economics, money, runs the world. It always has. You can incentivize people if you have significant controls as a government over the economic lives of people. Well, you can certainly incentivize them to give up other liberties. And this has happened. People, by and large, seem very willing to prioritize economic security over complete individual freedom. So we see things like tax incentives, so on and so forth. When it comes to the question of what happened to citizenship in the United States after the Civil War, what changed about the relationship between the United States government and the people of the United States after the Civil War, during the period of Reconstruction. I realized that at about the same time I was being introduced to Howard Zinn and the corporation and that viewpoint, I had made another discovery that didn't seem as relevant at the time, but later turned out to be pretty damn important, and that was the arrival of the Prussian schooling system in the United States, which also put a significant dent in individual liberty. But both of those explanations are told through a conspiratorial lens of history, where a small group of people was able to change the course of all kinds of events and circumstances for everybody else. Now, there are certainly groups, as we've covered on the show before, there are certainly groups who do get together in secret and do try to do this, and sometimes they succeed. And most of my approach to history, I have to admit, goes through that lens. But one of the great challenges and satisfactions of working with and talking to and reading Thaddeus Russell has been the realization that there are several subjects, there are several areas of study, specifically in American history, that simply don't seem to make sense anymore if only viewed through that particular lens once new information is added. It doesn't mean that that lens isn't important, but it just means that it's not the whole scene. And there is a social, cultural lens that is very, very important and often overlooked. And I started thinking about this, quick tangent here. I started thinking about this when I was watching the Netflix original series, House of Cards. House of Cards is about this congressman from Georgia, I think, right? He's a representative of the people. So, as the show went on, I noticed that one group was strangely absent from the show almost entirely. The people he was supposed to represent. In fact, the entire show is about the workings of the U.S. government, largely between the legislative and executive branch. And there's politicians, for sure. They're the stars of the show. There's the press. There's the lobbyists. There's the even sort of more behind-the-scenes wire pullers. But there's no people. The people are absent from the story, and I think it's an interesting statement about what the focus of government is, if it's intentional. But the people, I believe, play into history much more than a solely conspiratorial or central planners control the world view of history would suggest. So one of the important distinctions that Thad makes today is there's a formal culture. Right? When we talked about looking through history through a cultural lens, there's very much a formal culture, an agreed upon brand that, you know, this is American values, American beliefs, the American lifestyle. But then almost always in contrast to that is popular culture, right? Which now has to be, because of modern media and the internet, now has to be more recognized by the people who want to promote a formal culture. Before this type of media, before we had that window into the wants of ordinary people, the Rick Santorums won. The Rick Santorums, the people who had that puritanical mindset and power to go with it, they decided what went into the history books as important to the American people, or what the lifestyle of the American people looked like. It was entirely false. We have significant distortions in our understanding of history because formal culture won out over pop culture. The people, their wants, their desires throughout most of history are entirely invisible, which is why your American history textbook in public school is just kind of talking about presidential administrations. But a cultural history is almost entirely absent. It only the agreed upon safe elements of formal culture are included. So this is a challenging time, this Reconstruction period, the end of slavery and Reconstruction. And I had a lot of questions in the question of what happened to the freedom of people. My understanding started with the idea that it empowered the federal government to help their corporate friends. And then, of course, the schools came into it. And that was, you know, needless to say at this point, very helpful information in trying to understand the transformations that began to take place in this period. But there was something else at play as well, and that's what we're going to try to address on the show today. Here we go.
When he rubbed burnt cork onto his white face, Dan Emmett knew the secret of slavery. When he let his body move on stage the way he never would off stage, he knew what the abolitionists would not say. When he sang songs of easy work and lazy days, told jokes about sex in black dialect, and heard his audience roar its approval, he knew what our history textbooks still kept secret. Emmett, one of the creators of the Blackface Minstrel Show, knew that slaves enjoyed pleasures that were forbidden for white people. He knew that slaves were often the envy of America. Whites imitating blacks is America's oldest pastime. It was during the war that Emmett gained national prominence for his most famous song, which today is known as the anthem of Southern racism. But for Emmett, was actually a wish to be a slave. I wish I was in Dixie. Hooray, hooray. In Dixieland I'll take my stand to live and die in Dixie. Away, away, away down south in Dixie. Freedom to me will never pay.
Today is concerned, I thought we would do the freedom of slavery. If we have time, the slavery of freedom as a follow-up to this. But if necessary, I guess we could wait till next time. You're all set to deal with any part of that?
Sure.
Okay, we can start like this. I was teaching an SAT class Sunday, and we were doing the critical reading, you know, where you read passages and then answer questions about them. And I flipped to this new one that I had never seen before. I read it and I said, wow, holy shit, and not out loud. And I immediately thought of you. Are you ready? I want to read you one paragraph of this. First published in 1976, this passage discusses W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey, two leaders of the Black American community in the 19-teens and 1920s. The concept of two warring souls within the body of the Black American was as meaningful for Du Bois at the end of his years as editor of Crisis, the official journal of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, as it was when he first used the image at the start of the century. The tension between race pride and identification with the nation as a whole was nowhere more dramatic than in the most controversial editorial ever printed in Crisis, Close Ranks, which in July 1918 called on Black Americans to forget our special grievances and close our ranks. That was a quote, with white people, quoting again, fighting for democracy during the First World War. Bitterly criticized by black people, Du Bois barely modified his statement when 2 months later, he set the priorities for his readers. Quote, first your country, then your rights, unquote. Perhaps the editor had written more than he intended in using the word forget.
for crisis before and after the editorial showed no diminution in its criticism of racism. But he distinguished between Allied and German ambitions and declared that the defeat of the former would be disastrous for that, quote, United States of the world, to which he was most loyal. React.
Well, what's your reaction to that?
Initially, my thinking was, and I was thinking about this on the way home, if I heard a white person say that today, like, forget about your personal freedom and join together for the nation, I would call them a slave in maybe a more jackalish kind of moment, not being compassionate, not trying to understand what they're really saying there. But I would say, how could somebody who understood some of these issues, especially at that time, as well as Du Bois, or my understanding of Du Bois, I know you mentioned him in the chapters we're going to discuss today, how could he have a mindset like that? What had to happen? And how common was that? How many Black people who could remember slavery or knew former slaves had adopted that mindset? And how did that happen?
So you're reading that as assimilationism?
Yeah.
And integrationism?
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, Du Bois, and it's pronounced Du Bois, by the way.
Oh.
That's okay. He went through many phases. He's a very odd guy. There are moments in Du Bois' career when he looks like a Black nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, in several of the quotes in the book, you know, he celebrates the disreputable aspects of Black culture as being superior to the culture of whites, you know, which is very, very different than the quote you're reading.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, later in his career, he becomes an outright communist, capital C.
Yeah.
You know, so it's he's all over the map politically and intellectually. What you're talking about is a strategy that has been the norm, I would say, among civil rights leaders.
Yeah.
From Booker T. Washington, well, actually from Frederick Douglass through Booker T. Washington, Du Bois for a little while, and then King and the National Civil Rights Movement in the 50s and 60s, really to the present, which is the objective of African Americans should be to achieve full first-class citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
That has been articulated both as just a strategy that, you know, African Americans will never be safe, secure, and free until they have full citizenship.
Yep.
But it's also been articulated sort of in what you were saying there, as a good in itself, that America really is the greatest nation on earth, and that this is what anyone should aspire to be, you know, a full American.
Right.
So that is the object of my criticism.
Right.
So that's what I take on in the book and in other work I've done.
Well, just to interject really quickly,
yeah,
because the reason why I wanted to share this with you is because you do quote him in the book, and it is a quote that obviously came from a very different period in mindset in his life. And he's missing things, like he has some blind spots, but he's not talking about Black people and their need to forget whatever their special grievances are, whatever their culture is, and fully assimilate for the cause of war, right? So this is startling if you had only ever read what he's quoted in your book.
Yeah.
And it also...
Like I said, Du Bois is unlike almost anyone else. I mean, he went through very, very distinct phases in his thinking. He had a very long career. He lived, I think, well into his 90s and was writing pretty much his entire adult life. So yeah, it's odd. I mean, there's no one W.E.B. Du Bois. So the more particular strategy of serving in the military during war, right? Yeah. That's been a major strategy of immigrant groups trying to achieve assimilation and citizenship and African Americans since the Civil War, right?
Yeah.
So again, this is not sort of within that lineage, this is not unusual at all. This is the norm, in fact.
Yeah.
For Du Bois, it did contradict other parts of his career, absolutely. But everyone knows that. I mean, there's no secret that Du Bois was inconsistent.
Yeah.
Some moments in his career, he was, you know, he contradicted others. And I don't know what to do with that. I mean, people change their politics. I have changed my politics. I don't hold that against him. I think that's a that's that in that moment in his career is something we should think about critically.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's certainly a valid point. If somebody pulled up a bunch of my papers from graduate school and said, well, in 2001, Brett, you said this, you know, I'd be like, well, sorry, I didn't know anything then. So yeah. Certainly a person can change a lot in his life. But, you know, it was certainly an interesting statement juxtaposing that paragraph against having read these chapters in the book that we're going to talk about today. And it also called to mind something that I've said before on the show with less information than I think I have now. But it seemed like in starting in the 1860s, starting perhaps with the 14th Amendment, slavery wasn't, you know, sent to everybody equally, but it was basically a new kind of slavery was spread thinly to everybody at that point.
Do you mean a psychology?
Yes.
Do you mean among African Americans?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of white people, especially in the North, had already adopted this psychology that it had been put in them a long time ago. And what the chapter Freedom of Slavery drives at is that you couldn't put this into black people. They weren't going to buy into this.
Okay. Now I got it. Okay. So the argument is that the dominant American white culture from the time the Puritans landed, really until now, but it was most pronounced in the 19th century, is, one could say, a form of slavery, but it's not institutional, it's not structural, it's not material, it is cultural, and it is psychological.
Right.
Right? Okay. So what is that? There's several parts of it, but it is essentially, it's a system of repression, and I am hardly the first person to say this about American culture. And when I say American culture, what I'm talking about now is what I call American formal culture as opposed to popular culture. Very, very different things. But formal, for me, formal culture is what is promoted by political leaders, often business leaders, your school teachers, the mainstream media. And at the center of that culture, from the Puritans to the present, has been two things. One, the Puritan work ethic, which we've talked about.
Yep.
Right. And the other is the nuclear family ethic, which we've also talked about.
Yep.
Okay. So now, and it's interesting, you know, this is kind of where libertarians have a hard time with my argument. You know, my argument is that those things restrict people's freedom. In fact, that they restrict people's freedom more severely than any law, because law requires a cultural norm, in my view, to exist, to be enforced, to have any teeth, to really affect people's lives. So there are many laws on the books that are unenforced. So who cares, right, about those laws? It's when they have a moral norm upholding them that they actually do damage to people's lives. So formal American culture, the belief that we should work all the time and never have sex outside of marriage, and certainly never for fun, and we should live in a nuclear family our entire lives, we should dress, there are sort of other smaller pieces of it. You know, we should dress modestly. Dancing is not okay. You know, deference to authority is a major part of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was really dominant among white people. And I would say actually also among middle-class blacks as well, free middle-class blacks. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you could argue, and I have argued, that there has been really no greater proponent of the Protestant work ethic than middle-class black people in this country. So it's, you know, it's never, ever talk about, you know, black people or African-Americans as I hate it when people talk about the black community. It's like, who are we talking about here? There's actually been a major civil war among African-Americans around these very issues since the Civil War, major divisions on this question among African-Americans and as among whites, but I'd say even more so among African-Americans. So yeah, I mean, if you looked at textbooks given to the school children in the 19th century, you know, it told them to work all the time, never to play, you know, it never mentioned anything about sex, of course, because that was, you know, so evil, it couldn't be spoken aloud.
You mentioned, too, one man who was certainly, or suggested in the book that he's raised with those textbook influences. His name is Dan Emmett, and he's one of the creators of blackface.
Yeah.
And, you know, the chapter is challenging not to accept what's being said, but to really understand what it means and how to make use of it, how to fit it into, you know, a larger context. And what's argued is that blackface didn't entirely spring up because, ha ha ha, look at this, it's racist and funny. And that's not even why it was really criticized. It was criticized for being wild and free. And what's suggested is that it really represented, it's hard to say at first, right? It's a hard thing to introduce to people, the desires for the freedoms that white people observed in blacks who were technically slaves.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny for me. I know this. I've heard this 1,000 times from people that it's hard to hear that, but it seems completely obvious to me. Mm-hmm. And not just with the history of blackface, which we will talk about, but with the subsequent history of whites emulating black culture, you know, which is as powerful today as it ever has been. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, what's the most popular form of music in the whole world right now? It's hip hop, and yep. It has been for years. And who's the number one consumer of hip hop? White people.
Yep.
You know, and that's just the beginning of it. I mean, black slang, right? I mean, we all use black slang now. Even politicians use black slang now. I mean, it's an obvious attraction to black culture, the culture of the descendants of slaves among whites for forever, well, since slavery. And it just seems like it's been a major part of American culture, popular culture, not the formal culture, but the popular culture, for 200 years. So it's odd that people have that reaction to me, because it just seems so obvious. Now, what I do understand their skepticism about blackface minstrelsy,
yeah,
specifically being an expression of that. But you just have to look at the songs, and you have to read, there's not just me, but there's several other scholars who have made the same argument, that it was primarily, not entirely, primarily an expression of envy, that slaves in their culture enjoyed particular freedoms, not all freedoms. Their physical freedom was, of course, limited, right?
Yeah.
That whites did not allow themselves to have because they subscribed to this dominant repressive culture that we just talked about, right?
Yeah.
Which was really what we're talking about in the 19th century is sort of Puritanism merging with Victorianism. You know, the Victorian era begins in the 1830s in England, and it becomes very pronounced here, which was, you know, very much sort of an extension of Puritan beliefs. You know, this is highly repressive culture. I mean, many historians generally believe that England and America in the 19th century were the most repressive cultures in world history. I mean, they were comically repressive. I mean, there was one of the fastest growing industries in the 19th century in the United States was for devices that kept people from masturbating. There were books and books and books and books and, you know, medical journal articles written about the dangers of sex and masturbation. And at the end of the 19th century was the beginning of the sort of a very deliberate campaign against what became known as homosexuality. But, you know, forget all that. I mean, just sex, you know, just straight up missionary position, heterosexual sex outside of marriage was considered to be so dangerous it could cause you to go blind.
Mm-hmm.
So white people in this country invented that culture here and in Europe. They invented that culture. And here, even white people sort of considered to be working class or even poor subscribe to it, generally speaking. I mean, there certainly were some cultural dissidents, but not many. I mean, it was a dominant culture. It was a dominant set of beliefs. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You were considered to be a good white American if you subscribed to those beliefs. Now, the immigrants who came here during this period, first the Irish and then later on the Italians and Jews and others, didn't subscribe to it because these were foreign ideas in Ireland and in Italy and in Russia.
Yeah.
But in America, you were expected to subscribe to these beliefs to be considered a good American and to be white. So the Irish were not considered to be white because they didn't have these ideas. They didn't believe in the Puritan work ethic or the nuclear family ethic, et cetera, nor did the Italians or Jews, et cetera. So they actually weren't considered white until they assimilated, until they adopted these ideas, these cultural norms.
Yeah, you see old posters of Irish people and they're drawn to look exactly like these kind of derogatory treatments in cartoons of black people. They just have white faces.
The Irish were considered to be actually below African Americans. They were actually considered to be simians.
Yep.
The Italians and Jews were considered to be black. They were, I mean, literally, they were actually specifically considered to be black African. I mean, people are surprised by that. But there was a just one example. There was a book written in 1910 by a social scientist that called "The Jew is a Negro." I mean, with this huge, you know, 200-page argument about how they were African.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is an internalization of repression of power that obviously severely restricts your freedom. Right now, of course, it's voluntarily entered into. No one's forcing people to do this at the point of a gun. I get that, right? But it's so powerful that it causes people to live in ways that many of us would see as walking prisons.
Yeah.
Now, African slaves had obviously absolutely no reason, no incentive to adopt that culture, right?
Yeah.
Not only did they have no incentive to, they were, of course, in a sense, forcibly removed from it, right? I mean, slavery physically, forcibly kept them separate from that very repressive culture. So you can see that there's an irony here built into this relationship.
Right down to the point where a lot of the laws didn't even apply to them in the South.
Right. And so people miss this. I mean, it's like, it's just, you know, slavery and segregation have just always been seen as just simply negative, right?
Yeah.
And now, of course, who in the world, including me, would want, you know, thinks that segregation is a good thing, physical segregation. But there was an unintended ironic benefit to that, which was that they did not enter into this comically horrible, repressive, ridiculous culture. And so they were free to create their own culture. Now, Du Bois was the first person to say this.
Right.
In the 1930s, he wrote this, you know, he wrote this about slave culture. He said, you know, slaves had no reason to make themselves into mechanical draft horses that whites had. They had no reason to limit the movements of their bodies. They had no reason to stop dancing the way that whites had. This is why jazz came out of those people. You know, jazz is the music of improvisation. It's the music. It's called the music of freedom. Right? We know this. This is what jazz is defined as. Well, is it any coincidence that it came out of slaves? And you know, not just jazz, but a whole set of cultural behaviors and attitudes that are, in my view, in the view of many people, more liberated. So, for one thing, sex. Slaves simply had. They didn't have any. It's not that they had no moral norms about sex, but they had much looser ones. So they didn't think that having sex outside of marriage was wicked. They didn't think that a woman who had sex before she was married was, you know, a whore. They didn't think that children born outside of marriage were bastards. Their relationships were much more fluid, and they had no sort of moral proscriptions against what we would call sort of promiscuous dating now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, I'm not the first historian to say this. I mean, other historians have done this work and shown this. And then on work, you know, that seems like an obvious one. They obviously had no incentive to work hard ever. And so they worked, they viewed work as simply a means to an end, not a virtuous end in itself, which is what Americans think and have always thought. That work, no matter what you get for it, is a good thing. Slaves never had that idea. Now, all this slave culture was partly because they had no incentive, because, you know, they weren't allowed to marry, not formally, no state marriages. And of course, as chattel slaves, they had no incentive to work hard either. But it wasn't just that. It was actually also foreign. These ideas were foreign to West Africans. So when they got here, they didn't bring these ideas with them. You know, those ideas about work and sex did not exist in West Africa. They didn't exist in most of the world. And in fact, they still don't exist in most of the world. Most people in the world don't think work in itself is virtuous. And most people in the world live outside of nuclear families. So they came and they were here and they had this culture. They developed a culture that was much looser and freer than white American culture. And they've been doing it ever since. And whites who restrict themselves in all these ways and get the benefits of being white, and so therefore will not veer too far from that repressive culture because they do get a benefit. And Du Bois called that the wages of whiteness, which are real. You know, when you and I get in a car and drive somewhere, we don't worry about the cops pulling us over because of the color of our skin, right?
No.
you know, it's fucking real. Like, you know, still to this day, you cannot deny that there is, you know, racist discrimination. You may not call it racism in the scientific sense, but this is real. We get, you and I get benefits and privileges simply for being white, and we, and whites always have. That is why, according to several scholars, including me, whites wouldn't give up this repressive culture, because that was the deal.
Yeah.
You repress your body, you put your body into this prison, but in exchange for that, you don't get hassled by the cops and you get to vote.
Right. Yeah. For a long time, too, I had heard stories, and I guess I had more of an economic understanding of what was going on in the South during slavery. And I did an episode of the show years ago called Drapetomania, which was talking about Samuel Cartwright, yeah, who you mentioned in the book. And sure, for those who are unfamiliar, Drapetomania was this scientific explanation. So they tried to use science to explain the problem and say that, oh, you know what it is? They're mentally ill. And there was two of them. There was one called Drapetomania, which is very similar to what we call oppositional defiant disorder today. And there's another one that Bruce Levine, I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work,
yeah,
he told me about. He says it was called dysthesia aethiopis. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but that was very similar to ADHD, the failure of the slave to pay adequate attention to the master's needs. And,
right,
you know, so I said, okay, well, of course, there's economic motivations for this. That's the real reason, because isn't it so ironic that as a lot of these guys who realize that, you know, they run these plantations and they see that the output, the productive output, is at best less than optimal. Well, if you're forcing people to do it, of course it's not going to work. And isn't it ironic that at the same time in America, they're setting up a similar system to get a productive output from children, you know?
Right.
But this, what you're saying in the book, it doesn't just, obviously, we want to be clear, it doesn't just apply to black people. It applies to Italian immigrants or Irish immigrants or anyone who wasn't deeply emotionally and psychologically and culturally rooted in what are, you know, originally distinctly British values.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So here's the thing. And, you know, what has happened is, everyone in our culture, socialists, liberals, conservatives, libertarians, everyone basically, has also internalized those norms. You know, we assume, we don't even assume, we just, it's like in our DNA. We know that work is good. You know, like, we know that being in a family is good. And so my job is always to say, first, why do you believe that? Why is that necessarily a good thing? Why, what, you know? And I said, is it really, do you guys really think we should, I say this to my students, you know, do you really think that work in itself is virtuous, you know, no matter what you get for it? And they're like, oh no. Okay. All right, fine. Do you really think that the only way for people to live healthy, happy lives is in a nuclear family for the rest of their lives in monogamy? Well, no, not really. Oh, good. Okay. So then, if the stereotypes of black people are true, who is the superior group? Right?
Okay, well, what about this, though, right? Because you work, you enjoy what you do. Maybe we're not using the right word. I ran into a friend today in town. He goes, oh, man, I'm working all the time. I love it. I said, well, yeah, you love what you're doing, you know, and I said, is it work? But what about this idea of work, like actually investing time and effort and learning and labor into something we enjoy? Imagine if religion had just never been a part of that, if these Puritan values had just never been a part of that. Of course, Cotton Mather said to work was to be godly. Of course, Puritans pushed this idea that idle hands travel into the pants. You know, that kind of, I'm sure that's a part of it, right? And even Ben Franklin, who was no kind of Puritan at all, certainly as one of the administrators and managers of early America, benefited from other people adopting a Puritan lifestyle. We talked about that before. But what if, I mean, we're not just saying that work is bad. We're saying work as identity, you know, as this major part of your identity, I'm good because I do what I'm told or I sacrifice is good.
Yeah, no, it's the belief that it's good in itself.
Okay, yeah, I agree.
That's it. That's the problem. So the belief that work is a necessary means to have nice things, what's wrong with that? You know, I mean, it's an obvious thing. Do we want to reduce that work as much as possible? Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that most Americans do though. but I do. Whenever we get new technology, we should see it as a labor-saving device, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not a labor-adding device, which is what most Americans do. That's what happens with cell phones, right? We get this amazing technology that has, you know, I said this in New Hampshire a year ago, right? Basically more productive build capacity than a steel mill.
right. You know?
And what do we do with it? We make ourselves work more.
Yeah.
We use it to work all the time. That's what we do with our fucking cell phones. We use that thing, that amazing magical device, that labor saving device to work all the time. That's America, man. So I'm actually going to be on the Independence talking about exactly this, I think this Friday.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had me on to talk about work and the work ethic. And we're going to, we taped last week. The show's, I think, going to be this Friday. But anyway, so look at the numbers. Just look at the numbers. We work hundreds of hours more per year than the Danes and the French and the Germans and the Norwegians and the British and the Australians and the New Zealanders. Hundreds of hours more per year. But gross domestic product per capita is basically the same.
right.
Among all those countries, I mean, we're like sixth or seventh, you know, among them. But, you know, the ones, and then we're basically, it's basically all about the same. We live about the same in terms of material wealth as those kind. Okay, so what the hell, man? So why, you know, so there's no, to me, there's no longer any argument for working hard.
Like, right.
You know, I can understand, like, If you can't have material prosperity without working all the time, okay, there's an argument there, but you can. Here's another obvious argument against this. How did Americans live materially 120 years ago? So, compared to how we'd live now?
Right.
Terrible.
Yeah, right.
How much did Americans work 120 years ago? They worked 60, 70, 90 hours a week.
Right.
Okay? And now we work too much, but we work 40, 50, 60, whatever, a lot less. We have more stuff working far less. Okay. We can do it. We can work less and still have very, very nice things. The reason I believe that we work so much more than these other countries, even though we don't actually get anything more for it, is this idiotic Puritan work ethic that Americans work hard. I understand a lot of Americans work hard to get nice things. I get that. But I do think it's the ethic of the work in itself is good is also deeply ingrained. You see it suffusing this culture. You see it all the time. Every political speech has some reference to the work ethic. When you watch a sports game on television, the commentator always talks about the work ethic of this or that unpaid college basketball player, right?
Right.
It's all over the place. I mean, go to schools, goddammit. In schools, they preach it all fucking day. It's like, do they ever tell kids you should work hard only to get a flat screen TV? No. Never. It's work is good in itself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They celebrate the saints, you know, the people who have worked, the volunteered people who have worked, you know, sacrificed themselves, have gotten nothing for it. It's this communitarian, collectivist, puritanical shit. And, you know, we can live better, Americans. We can live much better. We can have free time and still have our smartphones.
Absolutely. So let's return to the work versus non-work world of the 19th century for a minute. And a lot of people don't know this, but one of the programs in the New Deal, some kind of a writing project that they did, was they sent out these writers to go interview over 2,000 living ex-slaves, I think, in the 1930s. And you include some of this in the book, and there's some interesting accounts, and this is leading to a question and hopefully a challenge. One of the men interviewed is named Quattlebaum, and he says something like, you know, easy living is maybe half of life for white folks, but it's all of life for us. And there's a lot of other people who say very, very similar things. And then you even bring in the work of a quantitative historian, and it's talking about after emancipation, and the numbers, I'll read them real quickly and we can discuss. 9% of enslaved blacks in the South left immediately after emancipation. Over 18% stayed for up to a year. About 15% stayed on the plantation for 1 to 5 years. And over 20% stayed on the plantation for 5 or more years. So let's say I'm a conservative. Let's say I'm Sean Hannity, but I actually know who you are. And for some reason, I've actually read this chapter of the book, right? So I'm saying, well, this is a glamorization of dependency and the shirking of responsibility, right? Because slavery guaranteed so many things for these people, right? That it would be understandable that they would adopt in many other ways when they weren't in the fields a life of, you know, whatever leisure they could find or afford.
Yeah, so I'm used to responding to the liberal response rather than the Sean Hannity response, but it was called the Federal Writers Project, and they interviewed 2,500 ex-slaves, and a solid majority of them, not all, but a solid majority, and this is not controversial, I mean, everyone agrees with this, express positive views of their time as slaves. Mm-hmm. An even larger majority, and I don't even mention this in the book, expressed fondness for their masters. That's a part that, you know, actually, that's not what I'm arguing, and I don't really even, that part even sort of bothers me.
Yeah.
I don't love that, because I'm not, you know, I'm not pro-master here. And in fact, you know, if you read the chapter, you will see, you know, what I'm talking about is resistance to the masters and slavery. So yeah, and one of the things they talk about, these ex-slaves, a lot is how their time as slaves required much less work than their time as quote unquote free people. So historians have been sort of wrestling with what to do with this evidence for a long time.
Yeah, readers too, for sure.
Yeah, no, and it's, you know, and it's tricky. It's not clear cut. And I say this in the footnotes. You know, you have to deal with these things carefully. So here's some problems with those interviews, okay? Mm-hmm. Which historians have been well aware of. And a lot of historians use them and some don't for these reasons. So one is, you know, these interviews were conducted in the 1930s, which means that these people were pretty old, from their 70s to their 90s. And B, most, although not all, were children when they were slaves. There were several, many of them were at least teenagers and a few were in their 20s, but you know, they were young and most were children. So just how accurate are their memories, you know, of that time, right? It's mm-hmm. a good question. And then the second criticism that's been made of the use of these interviews is that about 2/3 of the interviewers were whites. About 1/3 were black, but about 2/3 were white. And they were all the interviewers, of course, were employees of the federal government, you know, going mm-hmm. down south and talking to these poor black people, right? And so the argument's been made that these black people, these interviewees, you know, felt compelled to speak well of their masters and of whites generally and of their time as slaves because they were afraid of these power figures, you know, these authority figures. Mm-hmm. Who knows? We don't know. I mean, this is all speculation. We don't know if that's was in the minds of these ex-slaves at all. I actually think that assumption is a bit patronizing. I have no reason to believe necessarily that Junius Quattlebaum, who you quoted, was intimidated by this 25-year-old white graduate student from New York City. Mm-hmm. Why? I mean, why should he have been? And in fact, if you look at the text of these things, they often speak in a way, in a context, ex-slaves actually often speak in sort of a patronizing way toward the interviewers.
Yeah. Yeah.
They often call them like little miss, little mister, you know, and it's sort of like, I don't actually see that dynamic in the interviews. The age question is certainly there. You can't deny that. That is an issue. You know, if you were 9 years old on the day of emancipation, how much are you really going to remember? But here's the other thing, though, people don't take into account. Yes, they may have been children during slavery, but immediately after slavery and for the rest of their lives, they were around, surrounded by all kinds of people who had been slaves as adults. Yeah. Right. So they were getting information, lots and lots of information their entire lives from people who had been slaves all the way through adulthood. Right. So these are pretty good sources.
Yeah.
You know, in my view, even if they were children when they're slaves, there's pretty good sources for what it was like. And for most importantly, not what it was like, because who knows? I don't believe in objective reality in that way, but for what the slaves thought of their lives. That's what's important. What did the slaves themselves think of their lives? That's all that matters to me in this case.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's pretty clear. Now, you know, many, many, many slaves in those interviews absolutely talked about getting whipped, about being sold away, about being forced to work, you know, mm-hmm. absolutely. Very few talked about rape. By the way, that's another question. It's this evidence that's like very difficult for people to see, to look at. And so I've noticed that in the 60s and 70s and in the sort of in the 80s, but certainly in the 60s and 70s, historians used these a lot. And then since then, you'll see they've sort of slipped away in the histories of slavery. They tend to be talked about less and less, or they get cherry picked.
Yeah.
So people go and they take the most, you know, horrific examples of them.
And you mentioned that most of the time you are kind of responding to criticisms from the left. And I'm interested in hearing about that because, well, I mean, you know, just first of all, when I was reading these accounts, these interviews, I kept thinking of this Harriet Tubman quote where it's attributed to Harriet Tubman, whether she actually said it or not, but it's a powerful statement. I freed thousands of slaves, could have freed thousands of more or more if I could have convinced them they were slaves. I've used that quote on this show so many times. And
yeah.
That came to mind. I was like, oh, okay. I kind of understand it a little bit better now, what that meant. But yeah, you're right. There are all kinds of things that do warrant a deeper investigation to really, really understand what's being said there. But I think it does. It speaks to the important cultural differences and the important psychological differences that we've been addressing for most of the last hour. That's what's important to me. I'm sure there's been, you know, racists or what were they called? Fire eaters who would have, if they had records of slaves saying stuff like that in the 1860s, they would have said, oh, well, see, it's not such a bad institution. And I'm sure racists used it later on to speak to the scientific inferiority of blacks. Like, look at these people. They liked slavery. You know, what does that say?
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's been misused in a variety of different ways. But all of this is pretty much vanished at this point. Like, I have read a lot of history. I taught history for a couple of years. This was startling to me, most of what I read in this chapter. So the question is, and you can also address your liberal critics here, how did this happen? Because you said one of your advisors was Foner, right? The guy who wrote one of the most popular Reconstruction books. It was a college textbook when I was in college. And it seemed like it was a typical kind of left-wing story, like, oh, this didn't fail. We just didn't do it hard enough. We just didn't do enough of
Reconstruction. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can respond to that. And I'm also interested in hearing about what the liberal criticisms have been.
So this has to do with the history of what I would call, racial liberalism,
mm-hmm.
Since World War II. It sort of begins in World War II. And, you know, to understand this, to understand the way we think about slavery, you have to understand the history of racial liberalism. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's actually history since about 1944. In 1944, Gunnar Myrdal, Swedish sociologist, published a book called An American Dilemma, which is really kind of the founding text of racial liberalism. And again, you know, this is everyone agrees on this. So Murdaugh and this new generation of racial liberals, they did something really good. They did something fantastic and revolutionary and, you know, that we all benefit from and is absolutely liberatory and should be celebrated, which is they overturned scientific racism. Mm-hmm. So scientific racism is now discredited. It has been discredited for decades, which of course, liberals, you know, the dumber liberals sort of deny this, and they think that, you know, college administrators or scientific Ku Klux Klansmen, it's just absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, you can't go around talking about black people being biologically inferior. I mean, you know, it just doesn't. Whereas before 1944, 43, that was absolutely respectable and normal. Harvard professors talked about black people, not to mention just black people, but the Jews and Italians being biologically inferior. It was completely respectable, right?
Oh, and there was plenty of license. I mean, I'm just thinking about that kind of science in the first half of the 20th century and what it licensed, not just in America, you know,
sure,
as far as eugenics and but go on,
yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, that's what these people did. So Murdaugh, in his book, you know, really crushes this. But there were other authors at the time who really went after scientific racism. And then World War II, I mean, the fact that, you know, America and the Allies were, you know, fighting this racist regime, right? I mean, that was the justification for going to war, which really sunk in the culture, was that, oh, gosh, racism equals Hitler. That's not mm-hmm. good. Mm-hmm. So it was absolutely discredited, you know, after World War II. So that was great that they did that. Now, here's the thing that they also did that no one ever talks about. In Gunnar Myrdal's book, and he goes on, he devotes two whole chapters to this. He says, the problem with black people, or the problems that black people have been caused by whites through mm-hmm. slavery and segregation. Mm-hmm. But slavery and segregation, Myrdal said, created in black people an inferior, degraded, over-sexualized, slothful culture.
Yeah.
And for them to become full first-class citizens of the United States of America, they must, and these were his words, adopt the dominant culture of white people. They must assimilate into the dominant culture of America, he said. They must learn thrift and modesty and the work ethic, and they must stop having sex outside of marriage. They must stop being hostile to white people. They must give up their anger, their resentment. They must become white. So he lays out this very clear assimilationist program for them.
Yeah.
He was explicit about it. That the explicitness of assimilationism has kind of faded away. You know, it's sort of like people get embarrassed. You're not sort of allowed to say that now.
Yeah.
But I would say that racial liberalism, as he laid it out, is the way we think about race. It's the way we think about black. It's like, it's all assumed. Barack Obama is what black people should be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, then, you know, the way that whole thing played out, the Obama phenomenon, that was, you know, the most classic evidence to me that Gunnar Myrdal's vision has been realized, that is the way we think about race. Obama is great because he is just like us. You know, he is just like white people.
well, there's some people who aren't, there's a lot of people who aren't on board with that, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah. No, I know. Yeah. So those people are stupid. Mm-hmm. No, I mean that. Like, they don't understand this, right? So the Fox News is of the world, right? They don't get that. It's like, every time I'm on one of those shows, I'm like, guys, you don't understand. He's your best friend. He is exactly what you want. He is the ultimate expression of conservatism.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I don't bother with them. No, I mean, it's just, they're too stupid to deal with and waste time on. No, it's liberals who should know better, right? Who invented the goddamn thing anyway, racial liberalism. It's the idea that it's a twin idea. Black people are not biologically inferior, mm-hmm. but there's the other side of it is, I love this. It's such a paternalistic assumption. Black people aren't inferior. In fact, they can be and should be just like us.
They should be capable of.
What's that?
They should be capable of aspiring.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, no, they can be just like it is the most arrogant, imperialist assumption. And let me tell you something, Brett. In my view, it is basically in the minds of almost every white person in this country. Well, that is what animates white people's ideas about race in this country.
Yeah.
Liberals. You know, that's their idea. Oh, no. Black people, they're not really their rap music is terrible. But, you know, it's not because they're biologically inferior. It's just because they haven't had a chance to become like us and to play Mozart.
Well, I think that another part of it, too, and I mean, I used to think it was a lot simpler than that. I look at the narrative of government school. Once upon a time, there was a problem because there wasn't enough government or people had too much freedom. But by the end of the chapter, there's always good news. You know, there's always more government and a little less freedom and life is better for it. But, you know, I really, you know, reading this, one of the things that was just so eye-opening about these two chapters in the book, The Freedom of Slavery and The Slavery of Freedom, is I kind of realized this program that had just been running kind of in the background, this thinking that hadn't been reevaluated. We are supposed to automatically assess all slaves as pathetic and helpless.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The victimization. Yeah. The victimology. Yeah. That's a part of it too. Right.
Yeah.
So, and that's in Myrdal too. He says, you know, he says black people should adopt the culture of whites, but he says his argument is that it's really up to whites to help them. Like mm-hmm. whites created their oppression and whites can remove it, you know, only. It's imperialistic too. I mean, it's
and horribly collectivistic too.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, so it's white people as a collective with access to state power are the only people who can free these other people. I mean, it's, you know, that's it. I mean, it's like everything I'm against. I mean, it's like everything I critique is right there in those two chapters in Gunnar Myrdal. It's pretty awesome. So if you look, Brown v. Board of Education, 1954, right? The great integration decision by the Supreme Court. if you look at the decision, the majority decision written by Earl Warren, mm-hmm. there is exactly one footnote in that decision. There's only one cited source in it. And guess what that source is? Gunnar Myrdal's An American Dilemma.
And what is the specific reference?
They make the exact same argument. They say, we must integrate the schools because you need to read this, because the schools are the principal vehicle through which we make good citizens.
Damn straight.
Workers and soldiers. And it also says, we face a great opportunity. This is an opportunity, right? To make, now I'm paraphrasing, but to make these black people into useful objects of labor and sacrifice for the nation. Well, they were completely right. I mean, the logic is impeccable. Black people, though, that resource had been squandered, was the racial liberal argument.
Yeah.
They were kept out of combat in the wars. They didn't fight. They didn't actually go fight and die in World War II or World War I or, you know, or the Spanish-American War. They were kept out of combat unit. Well, Jesus, that's stupid. We could have had those black people going and getting bullets in their heads instead of our white boys.
Yeah.
They're not great workers because they haven't been put into the good schools. They haven't been trained to be workers. So we're wasting all this potential labor. That is Brown v. Board of Education. Read it. It's right there. It's amazing. And they cite Gunnar Myrdal. So the argument again is these people are not biologically inferior. They can be and should be made to be just like us.
Yeah.
They should be made. And so they get to do all the shit work too.
Yeah. That Brown versus the Board of Education excerpt echoes an abolitionist that you mentioned in the book. I want to say Channing, William Channing.
Yeah, William Ellery Channing, yeah.
And the thrust of his statement is, the problem with slavery is that the slaves are too free, you know?
Yeah, right.
They haven't been trained in this, self-sacrifice in the same way that the good whites have. And because of that, they are not functioning at their maximum usefulness.
Right. The abolitionists went on and on and on and on and on about how lazy the slaves were, how much fornicating the slaves were doing, how much drinking they were doing, how much partying they were doing, and they were appalled by it. And that was one of their major arguments for going to war against the South, was to end this institution and to get those people in their schools, which is exactly what they did in Reconstruction.
Yep.
Thousands of schools were set up by the Freedmen's Bureau and staffed by abolitionists who trained these ex-slaves how to read, write, and do arithmetic, but also how to live like good Christian white Americans who believed that sex was terrible and work was the only thing you should do. That's exactly what happened. That was the story of Reconstruction, unless you ask Eric Foner.
Well, we can. You're probably short on time, so we can leave it there for today. That was very well done. I had one question for you to end with, unrelated to what we just talked about. The last show, and I'm hoping that all the shows that we will wind up doing will generate controversy. The last one certainly did. Some people had some questions for you. Would you be willing at some time in the future to do a call-in format? Or maybe not the next show we do, but maybe one after that, I can just be collecting questions and I can either read them or I can let people call in and throw them right at you.
No, yeah, I'd love to do that. Yeah.
Oh, great. Great. I think there'll be a lot of people in the audience happy to hear that. So thank you so much again for your time. And I look forward to seeing what you do next. I'm glad you're busy.
Thanks.
You know?
Yeah, right. That I'm working hard.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. Here is a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me the suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run, but a brother like me begun to be another one. Held the enemy serving time, they drew the line, y'all. They criticized me for some crime. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran. On the strength of situations unreal, I got a raw deal, so I'm looking for the steal. Word them up, I'm looking for that steel.
Yo, man, we gonna break you out of there, man. We ain't gonna like that, man.
Don't you know, they got me rotten in the time that I'm serving. Telling you what happened the same time they're throwing. Four of us packed in a cell like slaves. Oh, well, the same motherfucker got us living in his hell. You have to realize what is the form of slavery organized under a swarm of devils. Straight up, word them up on the level. The reasons are several, most of them federal. Here's my plan anyway, and I say I got gusto, but only some I can trust, yo. Some do a bit from 1 to 10, but I never did, and plus I never been. I'm on a tier with no tears should ever fall. Cell blocked and locked, I never clock it, y'all. Cause time and time again, time they got me serving to those to them. I'm not a citizen, but ever when I catch a CO, sleeping on the job, my plan is on go ahead. I want a strength, but I'ma tell you the deal. I got nothing to lose, cause I'm going for the steal.
Hey, yo, Chuck, we gonna break you out of here, man. Words of strength, G.
I'm going for that steal.
Word up, G. They're trying to put black out of the game by keeping you in there, you know what I'm saying? But they can't keep a good man down.
Got it. Got me in the stuff.
Hey, yo, Chuck, we got it.
Got it. Got me in the stuff. Got it.
Hey, yo, Chuck, we got it.
Got it. Got me in the stuff.
deserve decency, well deserved. To understand my demands, I gave a warning. I wanted the governor, y'all, and plus the warden to know that I was innocent. Because I'm militant, posing a threat, you better fucking up the government. My plan said I had to get out and break north. Just like Oliver's neck, I had to get off. My boys had the feds in check, they couldn't try nothing. We had a force to instigate a prison riot. This what it takes for peace, so I just took a piece. Black for black, it's my time to cut the leash. Freedom to get out to the ghetto, no sellout. Six COs we got, we ought to put their head out. But I'll give them a chance, cause I'm civilized. As for rest of the world, they can't realize a cell is hell. I'm a rebel, so I rebel. Between bars got me thinking like an animal. Got a woman CO to call me a copter. She tried to get away, and I popped her twice. Right, now I wanna get nice. I had six COs, and now it's five to go. And I'm serious, call me delirious. But I'm still a captive. I gotta rap this time to break as time grows a tent. I got my steel in my right hand. Now I'm looking for the fence.
Hey, yo, Chuck, we got the dope plan in effect. G, word to the strap, man.
I'm looking for that. Into the courtyard, followed by 52 brothers, bruised, battered, and scarred, but hard. Going out with a bang, ready to bang out. The power from the sky, from the tower, shots rang out. A high number in dose, yes, and something close. I figure I trigger my steel stand and hold my post. This is what I mean, an anti-nigger machine. If I come out alive, then they won't come clean. Then I threw up, my steel bullets flew up. And to my surprise, the wall and tower blew up. Who shot what, who? What the bazooka was who? Into my rescue, it was a S1W. Secure my getaway, so I just got away. The joint broke from the black smoke. Then they saw it was rougher than the average bluffer. Cause the steel was black, the attitude exact.